Welcome here, everyone, to our afternoon session. I'm Heather Pryor, your moderator from King's University and the CSCA, which all of our speakers this afternoon have some connection to. Our first speaker is Matthew Morris from Calgary. Matthew is going to talk to us about naming taxonomic biology. Please.
Well, thank you very much. I'm a fish biologist. And reading the abstracts, I saw one talk with fish in it that's happening at the exact same time. So I'm amazed that anybody's here at all and not hearing about the fish. So thank you for coming. So the work I'd like to share today is work that I've done in collaboration with an Old Testament professor who unfortunately couldn't make it to this talk. She was going to co-present with me. So I have to handle the biology that I'm comfortable with and the theology that I am. There's a reason I went to an Old Testament scholar for this, because it's not my wheelhouse, but I'll do the best that I can to represent her fairly inaccurately. And you can send her emails saying how well I did or questions that you may have. So here's her contact information on the board there. So what I'd like to do today is talk about some work that I've done with Beth over an interdisciplinary conversation that was started by the Science for Seminaries grant that we received through Dozer. I got to work with a seminary, specifically a Pentateuch class, and we were thinking and talking about some of the resonances between the work that I do, which involves DNA barcoding of fish, and the work that she does. And one of the obvious areas was around Adam's naming of the animals and what that means, and what a broader theology of naming in the Pentateuch means for the discipline of taxonomy and perhaps vice versa as well. So those of you who we woke up today, went out for breakfast, we walked along this beautiful campus, and we encountered all sorts of creatures. There is tremendous biodiversity here at Point Loma Nazarene University. But I wonder how many of us actually saw the diversity that was around us. There's some pretty good research that suggests that we literally do not see the biodiversity for which we have no names, that our minds can't comprehend the differences between things if we don't have names for those things. So we likely encountered hundreds of different species of plants and insects and fungi and soil microbes as we walked here today, and likely saw a handful of them, like actually saw, made a mental note of a handful of those creatures for lack of names. In fact, some of the things that we encountered today likely don't have scientific names, particularly the things that were too small for us to see, particularly soil microbes that are highly understudied. Now, biodiversity surrounds us. There's an estimated 1.7 million named species on this planet, and likely hundreds of millions more remaining to be named. There are far more species to be named than people doing the naming. And that's in part because the science of naming is really complicated. It is not an easy thing to examine the variation within a set of organisms and determine what variation actually matters for delineating species and what variation is tangential. And so when you look at a picture like this, you might wonder how many species of skipper are being represented in this picture. And if you look at sort of these guys here on the left, they all kind of look fairly similar in terms of wing pattern. But these ones here look a little bit different from these ones here. Do we have two species here, 16 species, one species? What you're actually looking at, the columns 1 and 3 are the top and bottom of males.
Okay.
And these are the top and bottom of females. And the rows represent 4 different species of skipper. You kind of have to trust the taxonomists on this, don't you? They've devoted their life to looking at the minutiae of species and determining what variation actually matters and what variation is tangential, right? So taxonomy is not an easy pursuit. And if you don't know what I mean by taxonomy, I guess some definitions are in order. Taxonomy, from a biological perspective, is the scientific discipline concerned with the naming and classification of living things. And you may have heard of nomenclature. It's often associated with taxonomy. Nomenclature is the system of rules governing the naming of organisms. And if you are at all into this world, you've seen it's literally legalese that dictates how species can be named. It is very dry, it is fought over, and it is vigorously protected by various committees. There's one for botany, and there's one for animals, and then there's another one for viruses and another one for microbes and fungi and these sorts of things. Right, but there are rules. You can't just name something whatever you want. There are rules governing naming. So let's say you're wanting to get into taxonomy and you find these fish and you don't know what these fish are. You don't have a name for these fish. These fish look kind of different from other fish that you've encountered. If you're a taxonomist, the first thing you need to do is describe and justify this creature. Justify that it is, in fact, distinct from other creatures that might have shared morphological affinities or genetic affinities. So how is this thing different from this thing? And how is it similar to this thing? How is it different from this thing? Right? What you're seeing on the outside here are members of what we call the genus Oncorhynchus, which has some shared features with the fish here, but this fish might have some distinctions. And there's going to be a lot of these individuals, perhaps, and they might all vary slightly from one another, and some of that variation might overlap with variation over here. So you need to do a lot of work to justify that this thing is actually distinct and is worthy of a name. And in fact, this fish up here actually belongs with these fish here. These are sockeye salmon, male and female. But once you've justified that these things do, in fact, deserve a name, then you need to name them, and you need to publish that name. So naming this system of nomenclature, there's a series of rules, and some of the main principles include what we call binomial nomenclature, which means we scientists, we're going to use typically Latin or Greek names to try and cut through the confusion of common names. So this thing might be called a kokanee or a sockeye or a redfish, depending on the context, but scientists want something that's supposed to be stable. And so binomial nomenclature is the way of doing that. My name is Matthew Morris. My last name Morris lets you know what human group I'm with. I'm with the Morris clan. And Matthew lets you know which Morris I am. Similarly, binomial nomenclature, the genus lets you know the sort of affinities of this group. It belongs to the Oncorhynchus group. And NERCA lets you know what type of Oncorhynchus you're dealing with. So it's kind of like a last name, first name naming system. Okay, and so you just come up with a name. NERCA is the name they came up with here, the specific epithet it's called. And then there are rules governing syntax. These need to be English characters. You can't have ampersands and exclamation marks and these sorts of things in the name. It needs to be legible, something that you can sort of pronounce, right? But otherwise, it could be anything. The meaning doesn't matter. So long as there's a series of consonants and vowels that are pronounceable, that's what really matters in these names. The semantic content doesn't matter. There are some guidelines for changing the name. If you realize this thing actually belongs to the genus Salmo, there are rules for how you would go about changing that name. And then there are rules about priority and publishing. Like, what if you discover, I've just published this, it's named, but now we've dug up a paper, somebody else actually described this thing earlier. There's a rule of priority that says that earlier name is the name that is valid. And so your name is just kind of tossed out as a sort of a piece of history and might get listed under the relevant scientific name just so people know that that name's not being used anymore. So the full name of sockeye salmon is actually Oncorhynchus NERCA, Wolbom 1792. That's the full name of the species, where Wolbom is the person who first described him. 1792 is the year it was published. The brackets tell us that he didn't name it Oncorhynchus NERCA. He had it in a different genus, and the genus has since been changed. But NERCA, the specific epithet, retained. So that's boring. Good. Because the rules are very dry. And note, they don't tell you anything about what delimits a species. Right? There's no rules there about what is worth naming and what's not worth naming. They're just rules about naming itself. One sort of final rule is that of the type specimen. And theologically, I find this kind of interesting, although I don't know what to do with this. And maybe you guys can help me think this through. But names aren't applied to populations or species. They're applied to an individual or sometimes a few individuals that are called the type or the holotype. And so that holotype becomes the name bearer. And the name then spreads out from that individual to all other individuals that have shared affinities. And the reason for this is that what if we were to discover, this is a holotype of a species of cockroach. What if we were to discover that there's actually two species represented by one name? The holotype and everything associated with it retains the original species name, and all the other ones get the new species name with the new holotype designated. So there's one individual, sometimes a series, that are the actual name bearers, and the name kind of spreads out to the others by extension. And it doesn't need to be an average individual or anything like that. Usually it's an adult, but otherwise there's no real rules about that. It's just the first creature to be described. So when I think of biological taxonomy, I'm thinking of Carl Linnaeus, 1700s, Swedish biologist, who systematized binomial nomenclature and all of these rules. It's quite rigorous in his approach. But as a biologist who's a Christian, I can't help but also think about Genesis chapter 2. Linnaeus was identified by his critics as the second Adam, right? Because he was obsessed with naming. And in Genesis chapter 2, verse 19, the Lord God had formed out of the ground all the wild animals, all the birds in the sky. He brought them to the man Adam to see what he would name them, and whatever the man called each living creature, that was its name. Right? So we have Adam, who is naming these creatures. So talking to an Old Testament scholar, we realize that there's actually a lot to naming in the Old Testament. So in what ways might a theology of naming impact the discipline of taxonomy? And then conversely, in what ways might the discipline of taxonomy inform theological thinking about naming? So this is where I'm a little bit out of my wheelhouse, a lot out of my wheelhouse, but I'll do my best here. So when Beth first started approaching commentaries on Genesis 2:19, it quickly became apparent that many theologians are not thinking about the naming of animals for the sake of the animals. They're thinking about the naming of animals in terms of finding a helpmate for Adam, or a helpmeet for Adam, right? So it's all about Eve, not about the animals. But there are a few people who are thinking today about the relevance of naming, in particular the naming of animals, that God names the world into being, but then gives Adam this calling to then name a subset of creation, specifically the subset that he's responsible for ruling over. Scholars have been pointing out that there's a lot of ambiguity in this term Adam in Genesis 2, moving between the name of a person and a stand-in for all of humanity, suggesting that this vocation, this calling to name, isn't just a temporally located situation. You have one person naming animals thousands of years ago, but is actually calling for us today to continue this pursuit as humans in the naming of creatures. So this is, in a sense, not just Adam's vocation, but our vocation. It is how we exercise our responsibility to rule over, in part by naming the things that are around us, because otherwise we can't care for the things if we don't have names for them, right? Carol Yoon, in her wonderful book, Naming Nature, she's not a Christian, but she talks about the human affinity for naming. This is something ingrained in human biology. There's a region of the brain associated with identifying and naming biological entities. When damaged, you can no longer tell the difference between chicken and broccoli, but you can still name non-material entities, suggesting there's something profoundly human about naming. Furthermore, there's a whole discipline in anthropology called folk taxonomy that cultures in the ancient world and cultures all over the world today have rules for naming living things that often coincide very nicely with both binomial nomenclature, and they identify things that scientists consider to be valid species. So there seems to be something ingrained in human nature that's involved with naming. And naming is also a creative act. The theologians Mu and Mu argue that to name is to begin to know. That, in other words, Adam's naming of the animals was in part his being given this sort of command to figure out what lives around you, figure out the names for these creatures. What are these creatures? So that you can begin to know them, understand them, and then care for them. So there's a profound relationship between naming and stewardship. If Adam is to serve and protect the garden, he needs to know what lives in that garden. And in Genesis 2, we see this formula in Hebrew. I don't know how to pronounce this. I'll say it's Yikar and Shem, to call and to name, Yikar, Shem. And we see this same sort of formula in Genesis 5, only it's not Adam naming in Genesis 5. It's God naming humans. He's Yikar Sheming, and then he's asking us to Yikar Shem the animals. In Genesis 4, 12, and 13, the formula is modified to Yikar Shem Yahweh when people are calling on the name of the Lord. So calling on the name of the Lord is an act of worship. It is glorification of God. So the argument is that this construct suggests naming is to bring glory to God. Adam's naming of the animals is to bring glory to God, just as our calling on the name of the Lord is to bring glory to God. And in contrast, we see in Genesis chapter 11, a modification of this formula. Instead of Yikar Shem, it's Asa Shem. Let us make a name for ourselves. This is the Tower of Babel, right? This is people bringing on or trying to bring on their own glory. And so naming is supposed to be for the glorification of God, not for the glorification of ourselves. And finally, we see across the Pentateuch and even into the New Testament that naming carries with it life affirmation or a curse. If to name is to represent life, but blotting out names represents a curse. So to summarize that, Adam's naming of animals is not temporally restricted to Adam. It is a human vocation that we are all called to do. And it's not primarily scientific. You're not going to find all those rules, all that legalese for naming in the Bible. It's not taxonomy as a biological discipline, but it is the naming of animals as an exercise of being made in the image of God, as an exercise in being in relationship with these creatures, as an exercise in stewardship, as an exercise in worship. So, as someone who does DNA barcoding of fish, which is sort of the newest craze for naming, I see a lot of resonances between that theology and what taxonomists do. And when you read taxonomists, it seems like they anticipated or had a sort of intuition of an Old Testament theology of naming that can now ground their own observations about what they do. Because when you read taxonomists, they view what they do as a creative act. Now, they're not creating species, right? But they are creating order out of the chaos of biological diversity. When you see a field and you want to know how many things are living in that field, it's overwhelming. But starting to carve out names for those things helps reduce the overwhelming nature of that seeming chaos. So there's creativity there. But also, as I suggested before, naming creates things in our minds. It is creative in that sense. So in this paper from 1999 talks about plant blindness, this idea that people who go out into a field or a garden, they literally do not see the biodiversity of plants that surrounds them for lack of names. So we need to train people in botanical terms in order for them to appreciate the creatures that live around them, right? And so that is, the taxonomy is actually creating something for us. In fact, the shapes are behavior, right? Just yesterday, we went out and saw Torrey pines. We paid money to go out and see a pine tree because somebody had given it a name and set it aside from the other pine trees that are around and said, this has a limited distribution and is rare. So that changed our behavior, right? In 20 years, if scientists change their mind, doesn't change the fact that it's real for us right now. Taxonomists also view what they do as a relational act. We name what we love. Taxonomists often, not always, they can be frustrated with what they're naming, but they often love the things that they're studying. They're studying these creatures for a reason. They are looking at the tiniest little differences in the tibia or the antenna of these little insects under the microscope. They're straining their eyes. They're doing this because they love these creatures. They are engaged. They have knowledge, a profound relationship with these creatures that nobody else on the planet has. And when they die, they're likely taking that relational knowledge with them. It's likely that there will be nobody else who loves that creature like that taxonomist loved that creature, because there's too many creatures. You may have heard it said that God has a disordinate fondness for beetles because there are millions of species of beetles on this planet. Well, actually, they're probably not the most common thing. There's probably more species of microwasps than any other type of animal on the planet. Just there are more taxonomists who love beetles than there are taxonomists who love microwasps. Right, so we name what we love. And naming is also a protective act. There are, first of all, creatures can't be protected legislatively until they have names. But furthermore, there are rules to protect the names of endangered species, especially critically endangered species. So if scientists discover, this thing that's going extinct actually belongs to a different genus, we need to change its name, they won't change it. That name is protected because changing the name makes it vulnerable because legislation is slow to encompass those changes. sort of similarly, a little, maybe a little tongue-in-cheek, in 1975, the journal Nature published an opinion piece on naming the Loch Ness Monster, giving it a scientific name, just on the possibility that it's discovered. Because once it's discovered, it will need a name to protect it, because obviously it's very rare, right? So this is the Latin name for the Loch Ness Monster. But removing names similarly removes protections. Right? Not too long ago, you'd go to Seattle, birders would go to Seattle to cross off the Northwestern crow from their life list. 2020, the American Ornithological Society voted that this crow doesn't actually exist. It's just an American crow with a slightly different call. So if this population were to become vulnerable in the future, unless the state or province decides that it's sort of a unique thing that still needs to be protected, it's because it's lost that name and the American crow's fine, right? It's lost any legal standing for protection. So removing those names can be a curse for these creatures. So I see these resonances. I also see that there's a call for action. We can do more. So there, as I mentioned before, the semantic content of a name does not matter. It's just a flag saying this thing is different from this thing. But I would suggest that for the Christian taxonomist, the semantic content of the name should matter. Case in point, there's a blind cave beetle named after Hitler. It's been that way for decades. There's been very little desire to change that because the semantic content doesn't matter. But if protection is actually something associated with naming, the semantic content of this name has put this creature in jeopardy because it is being sold on the black market by neo-Nazi enthusiasts. It is being wiped out of existence because of the semantic content of its name. There are other reasons why this might be bad, this name. We think about naming for the glory of God. There are lots of accepted naming practices in taxonomy that are not for the glory of God. Patronage is a big thing in naming. Biologists often name things after the people who've given them money or that they want to give them money or they want to give them status. Most recently, names have gone up for auction. Taxonomists have sold naming rights to the highest bidder. This monkey, his name translates into Golden Palace, after the goldenpalace.com casino that bought the naming rights for this creature. That's not for the glory of God. This side-blotched lizard is named after Henry Stansbury, who was an important explorer and researcher, discovered all sorts of Utah and brought back scientific collections from Utah. He also was involved in the massacre of hundreds of indigenous people. And so there's been a lot of questioning about some of these species that are named after people. Right? President Trump has a species named after him. Is this to the glory of God? And then there are some that are more funny, like Agra. This dude's called Agra, and this guy was frustrated, so he called it aggravation. I think God might laugh on that. I don't want to be a stick in the mud about this. But there are others who named ugly animals after their ex-lovers, and maybe that's not to the glory of God. Finally, there's also people who name for their own glory. And they will take a one valid species and say, okay, there's five different populations, they're all a little different, give them five different names. And then they'll publish it for their own glory. That actually enhances confusion more than protection. But there are no rules governing what a species is. So they're allowed to do that. And other scientists are allowed to disagree, but those names are now there. So imagine you have a field guide written by someone who did this for snakes. You get bit by a snake, you identify the snake, go to the hospital, say, this is what bit me, and they say, I'm sorry, we don't have that antivenom because they have the other name on file, right? So this can actually do harm. What about very briefly for the theologian? If we take seriously that naming is protective and naming is relational and naming is loving, then the theologian needs to think very deeply about what it means to name the things we view as unlovable, like malaria-bearing mosquitoes or tapeworms and these sorts of creatures. I don't think we have a robust theology on what to do with these animals, especially in the context of protection, love, and relationship. What about stewardship of those creatures that are on the taxonomic fringes? I think of hybrids. Hybrid animals, I believe, are loved and valued by God. Evolutionarily, they're extremely important for future adaptation and genetic variation. But from a legislative standpoint, they don't have a name, they have no protection, and they're often viewed as being to the detriment of endangered species, that they reduce the genetic integrity of natural populations. So what do we do with these creatures that aren't named, that live on the fringes? What about the new creations, synthetic species that are being developed in labs, Who gets to name those things, and what do those names mean? Xenobots made out of African clawed frogs that are reproducing in the lab in ways that nobody anticipated. Theologically, how do we think about these creatures, and what sort of protections do they afford? Finally, I'll suggest that this has a call to action, not just for the theologian, not just for the taxonomist, but for everyone. All parishioners, all pastors, that naming is the work of a dom. It's the work of all of us. It doesn't mean you need to become taxonomists, but it means you're responsible for learning the names of the creatures that live around you so that you can better appreciate the biodiversity that surrounds you and so that you can facilitate the stewardship and loving care of these creatures. So to that end, thank you very much, and I hope there's time for a question or two.
Thanks, Matthew. I think we could take a couple of questions. We're starting a couple of minutes late. I'll let you field your own questions.
Sure, Arnold.
First, that was a great talk. I really appreciate it. It was so exciting and interesting. I mean, even though it's taxonomy, I was really astonished. And it resonated with my move to the West Coast where, you know, I saw coniferous trees, but then my wife identified, you know, spruce and hemlock and pine and sequoia and all of that. And now it's much more enjoyable. I have a question about indigenous peoples and names of plants and things. I noticed that you mentioned, like, the name, you know, names given by the first person who describes it. But these things have been described before the scientific has done it.
Yeah.
And in terms of indigenous reconciliation, this is really important in Canada. Is there any thought on dealing with that issue?
Yes. So, first of all, a bunch of common names have been changed recently, like McCown's Longspur. Longspur is named after, it's a bird, named after a guy who did horrible things to Indigenous people. Just recently renamed the Thickbill Longspur. So people are thinking about this. Science names are a little harder, in part because the semantic content isn't supposed to matter, in part because of legislation and protection and all those sorts of things. Now, the rule of priority stops at the 1750s. It stops with Linnaeus's publication, his botanical publication for plants, the very date it was published, or his zoological one. So anything before that, no longer priority. Right? So if you found, oh, geez, this obscure Greek guy actually published, so they wanted to get away with that, so they put in this firm deadline. Anything before that doesn't count, anything after that does. So that's where the real priority comes in. But there's been recognition for newly discovered animals that if there is some way of bringing in indigenous naming, that we should. And some of the rules regarding syntax seem to have been modified so that some of the indigenous, if there's like apostrophes or dashes or those sorts of things, I've seen them recently included in scientific names. I think, well, there is a big push to rebrand even the Latin names of creatures to provide more respect and healing for our indigenous neighbors. The downside, of course, is the things that haven't been named yet, are the things that the indigenous folk almost certainly didn't recognize either, the small microbes and things that weren't of any value, right? So it's the things that already have names that should be receiving new names. It's easiest in common names to do that, and a little more challenging in Latin names.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, just a quick comment. Again, you want to talk about theological reflection on the holotype, right? And, you know, here in about 30 minutes, I'm giving a talk on crap, why the... I don't use this terminology, but it means that from now on is how the early church of the unanimous and human Christ functionally at the holotype for humanity.
Oh, yeah, theology and all that's right.
You talk about theological reflection, then immediately it's mine. It's that Christ is normative of what it means to be a human, right? In the same way these holotypes are normative of what it means to be species X. Right?
Yeah, isn't it fascinating? And I don't know the history here, but I wouldn't be shocked if there were people who had some typological thinking who were coming up with these rules, you know, 100, 200 years ago. But I don't know if that's actually ingrained in the history or not.
I don't know.
It would be really interesting to know.
Before we see, is Christopher here?
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't get to tell you.
So. Oh, yes, Christopher.
Okay. So, do we take care of
him? Okay, then we can have lots more questions because, unfortunately, our next presenter is not here, and our third presenter is here, who's scheduled for 4:30, so then we can go on.
Okay. Well, it's a shame because it just seems like such a perfect nature's creature or something like that. It seems so perfect. Yeah. Sure.
So, when I pause, so I'm a chemist, and in chemistry, we have this chemical nomenclature system. Again, another thick book of rules.
Yeah.
But one of the characteristics of that is that the rule book is built around atomic names and structural features and counting features and so on. In other words, the name, and I like using some of this theology name as well in that kind of context, because again, that name means, actually, there is semantic content in the name because it's descriptive. How was there ever any sort of discussion of doing that in the world of taxonomy, or did Linnaeus get that? Did it get so entrenched before anybody thought of it that it was too late?
Bringing semantic content in,
or bringing doing something that actually does have that gets away from random words or human names in there.
So this gets a bit into some philosophy that I'm a little ill-equipped to deal with. But it's philosophy over what an individual is and whether a species constitutes an individual. And so individuals can be named in ways that populations can't. And so the whole notion of the holotype bearing a name that is just a flag for this, that's the reason that semantic content isn't included. But it's this whole philosophy around what names and what individuals constitute. And as I say, I'm not as well versed in that.
Because that was sort of a different question. It was this question of, sort of this morning, I think it was Swatomas talked a little bit, humans are one species,
So to speak.
Right? But yet there's this huge diversity. And so I looked at your butterfly and
comparisons,
like those are four species, and they're not, are they, are they incapable of inbreeding or something?
The species question is also philosophical, and also it's intractable. There is no one definition of a species that's possible. The biological species concept is the most common, so if they can't interbreed, then they're likely different species, but that means they can't potentially interbreed, because it's easy if they're living together. It's harder if they never come into contact with each other to know if they're going to interbreed or not. And most species aren't sexual. When you think of bacteria, viruses, many fungi, even some vertebrates are asexual, so the biological species concept doesn't apply. So, and if you're a paleontologist, you can't test it. You don't know if T-Rex could hybridize with an iguanodon. I'm sure they couldn't, but you don't know, right? So there's the morphological species concept in paleontology, and then there's the ecotype, or the sort of a niche partitioning model for the species. There's something like 30-some viable species definitions in play today. And taxonomists just need to say which one they're using, and that's sufficient to justify naming a new species. In the world of DNA barcoding, it's about a 2% DNA sequence difference for the cytochrome C oxidase 1 gene, that's how they justify cryptic species, and that's what they use for those skippers. They look morphologically identical. DNA barcoding said they likely hadn't reproduced or hybridized in a long time. And then when they finally found the caterpillars using DNA barcoding, they actually utilized different bees.
And a little more on confidence and things pertaining to that. There are certain cases where someone definitely had some fun naming things beyond the specific example you gave, or in the context of the name and the animal don't really seem to quite go together. Like one that I encountered, the binomial Godzillius robustus is applied to the world's largest species of ridicule. Ridicules are mostly marine crustaceans that look kind of like centipedes or millipedes. They're normally pretty small. The world's largest is that big.
Yeah, not much of a Godzilla, but a Godzilla for a remipede.
Less than a centipede.
Yeah, another classic example is the Oviraptor, right? Which means egg thief. This dinosaur found dead near an egg, so they just assumed it was eating the eggs. Turns out it was the mother, and those are her eggs. But once that name's ingrained, because the semantic content doesn't matter, you don't change the name. So that name's retained because it's just a flake.
Another obvious case of that that comes to mind is Tassis madagascariensis.
Well, Mark thought it was from Madagascar.
Oh.
It's not. It's from the Caribbean and the East Coast of the U.S.
Yeah, there's a bird called Apoda as well, which means without feet. But that's just because they cut the feet off to transport it, and the scientists didn't know. There's a great book. It's called The Naming of the Shrew. That's all about those little oddities and quirks of naming. It's a lot of fun if you're looking for a light read. There's another one called The Lost Species. It's all about museum collections and the funky names that are found in those collections. Another fun little book if you're looking for something. Sure.
So just a broader question of the semantic content of naming. So do you think in Genesis there was semantic content?
Yeah, that's interesting, right?
Because the command of God to humanity to name?
So you get all sorts of place names and people names that have some semantic content in Hebrew culture, right? So I can only suppose that Adam was called to name creatures in a way that brought out something about their identity. That's a supposition, like, I don't know, right? And so that's I think it's a way in which the Hebrew cultural naming conventions are quite distinct from scientific naming conventions. And as I say, because of the sort of philosophy of what an individual is and how you can name populations versus individuals, and it's stuff that I don't fully understand. I need to dig into it more. I doubt that Western science is going to quickly accommodate semantic content to names. But I do think that Christian taxonomists need to think about the semantic content, even if it doesn't matter if it impacts the possible protection of the species or if it impacts our love of neighbor. I think then it does matter, but maybe for reasons that are beyond the rules of taxonomy itself. Who has an idea?
Yeah, go ahead. As illustrations of challenges mentioned for kind of the stuff, scientific meaning, that also gets into challenges applying some of the suggestions for using indigenous names. There's often not really a one-to-one mapping of the indigenous name to scientific concepts. I mean, it's often, if it's something that was important to them, it's often pretty close. There are some differences, just like scientists are, but there's not a one-to-one mapping. Conversely, there are lots of indigenous cultures in the same regard. What do we call a cat? Is that going to be cat, shop, gadi? So there's complications there that some of the poets use indigenous names instead. Of course, also some indigenous cultures don't want a bunch of foreign languages butchering their language. And having continuity there are a lot of challenges to consider there. Likewise, political names. One article is arguing we should change names. Well, here's a species name that is today considered a pejorative ethnic term in South Africa. Yes, and it's also a name that is used as self-identification for another ethnic group with connections no longer there and connections to the area. So there are a lot of things where, trying to incorporate asking indigenous cultures, do you have names? Actually, we've got some species we're working on that we're checking with the local native tribes. Well, a couple hundred words were written down, 1700s before the language was lost. Would you like us to use some of those words?
Yeah, thank you for that, because there's like especially widespread species that overlap multiple indigenous languages. Which one do you prioritize over others? And you're right about there not being a one-to-one mapping. It's remarkably close, especially for the larger visible vertebrates like birds, and Stephen Jay Gould's work on that it's Papua New Guinea. 295 whatever species of birds, scientists recognized 293 of them had indigenous names, like something like remarkably close like that. But you're absolutely right, it doesn't go up on one to one. Yes, you do naming work.
But there's an effort to come up with some something that is manly, meaningful. Mm-hmm. But sometimes, okay, like aggravation,
yeah.
That was one where it's tropical rainforest beetles. There's a whole bunch of
that's right.
species already in the genus.
Yeah.
What's different about this one? Well, in this case, it was hard to tell apart. He had did a few hundred specimens before I was really sure this was one thing.
That's why I don't want to be too much mistaken about some of those things, because when you have 100,000 species in a group, there's only so many semantically meaningful names that one can have from that, or names of the group or cow or whatever, right? You're just going to be naming it thing by the water, and thing on a hill, and thing with red spots, right? Like, or naming that for all the different people you know. Because it just,
I think Terry will teach me impressive case of that for someone who was both doing the split things up a bit too much on the individual variation, but not as extreme as some other people would. On that, but also his system of naming was in going through species, alternate between name after every relevant person in the field and name after random mythologies.
That's right. That's
and when I say random, I mean random. Where and he included, say, Zeus, Venus, Vishnu, a couple of different Greek mythological monsters. Why
there's just only
after Geryon?
There's only so much that one can do when you're dealing with these really speciose genera, right?
Well, why don't we give Matt another round of applause? Thank you. Thanks for the very interesting discussion, such an interesting presentation.